Welcome to the History of European Theatre podcast, and thanks for joining me on this journey through millennia of theatrical history. Episode 117, William of Stratford, Part 1, To You, Your Father Should Be As a God. Last time, with the Shakespeare timeline, I completed the introductory episodes to this season. Now it's into the detail, with a series of episodes on the life of William Shakespeare. Many people find it difficult to reconcile the greatest dramatist of England being the son of the countryside, rather than a metropolitan or a well-travelled scion of the gentry. So it's worth having a look back as far as we can into William of Stratford's family and his origins. In previous episodes, I've talked about the many very significant changes that were happening in society through the upheavals that began in the reign of Henry VIII and continued up to and beyond the interregnum. And I will touch on some of those again here. But if you need a reminder of the detail, you could flip back to the early episodes of Season 5. William was born into a changing world, and in many respects a troubled one, where core beliefs and traditions were being questioned and overturned. But these changes also affected his father's and his grandfather's generations. Thankfully, we can start before William's birth in 1564, as there are some records that point to his ancestry. A few miles from Stratford is the village of Snitterfield, where William's grandfather, Richard, kept livestock on rented land. He was born in 1490, in the north of the county, but spent his working life in Snitterfield. Records there suggest that he was settled in the small community by 1529, where he had to pay a fine of 2 pence for not maintaining his hedges in proper order. This was not a particularly serious offence. There are many records of farmers being fined for not maintaining their boundaries properly. But had he not paid the fine, he would have had to travel to the semi-annual court in Warwick, some 6 miles away, to answer for his actions. He's also recorded as being present as a witness to value goods of deceased locals, a role taken when the deceased person was in debt to the appraiser, and as a jury member in a local land dispute. So it seems fair to say that he was at least comfortably off and of some standing in the local community. When he died in February 1561, his own estate was valued at £38, a respectable enough sum to leave behind you at the time, perhaps being equivalent to £15,000 today, but certainly nowhere anywhere near the super-rich heights that his grandson would reach. Richard had 2 sons, the elder of whom, John, born about 1531, would marry the daughter of Robert Arden, the man who Richard rented his family home and attached farmlands from. The other son, Henry, appears to have been a troubled man, who turns up in the record several times being fined for offences relating to the upkeep of his boundaries of his farmland that he rented, for a brawl, for trespass, for refusing to join locals charged with maintaining the highway, and for wearing a hat rather than a cap to church. That last one might sound petty, but the sumptuary laws were strict, and there could have been an element of protest about his choice of wearing the wrong sort of hat to church. This was at a time when laws were introduced enforcing the wearing of caps in an effort to support the English wool trade. Many of Puritan leanings objected to the enforcement and hence the protests. Henry was, nevertheless, a successful farmer and died relatively wealthy. John Shakespeare elected not to farm and sometime around 1550 moved to Stratford and became a glover. Not formally an apprentice, as there was no glover's guild at the time, but no doubt training under an expert in the creation of gloves from soft leather that was specially cured for the purpose. As a dresser of white leather, he would have prepared the hides of deer, sheep and horses after the initial tanning process to further soften them. He would then cut and sew the leather not only into gloves, but into aprons and belts and other soft leather goods. The trade was probably a good one, and a steady one, appealing to higher-end customers as well as providing for some more day-to-day needs of the townsfolk. The trade was protected by Act of Parliament, so didn't suffer any of the foreign competition that was a problem for some other trades. We know that John was in Stratford by 1552, because it was then that he was fined for not maintaining his household spoil in the communal midden heap. The records of the Leet Court, translated from Latin, say, Item, the jurors present under their oath that Humphrey Reynolds, Adrian Quinney and John Shakespeare make a midden heap in the place called Henry Street against the ordinance of the court, Therefore, they are fined, as so it appears. And against each name appears the sum of 12 pence. John and the others were not alone in that offence. Many Stratford residents were fined in a similar way over the years. But this has been taken as one of the indications that John could turn a blind eye to the rules. The communal midden heap was maintained at the end of Henley Street, and this entry, along with others, serves to remind us that the Elizabethans took public sanitation seriously and had some understanding of the health risks associated with it. Streets must have been muddy and wet in winter, but the image of residents throwing human waste from windows or of every street running as an open sewer would be wrong. Residents were expected to control their waste by using the communal midden heap or spreading the contents of their waste onto the fields in a controlled way. However, there is a problem generally with leather workers and tanners in particular, who had a notorious reputation for creating a lot of unpleasant waste, which isn't surprising, given that they used both animal excrement and human urine in the tanning process, and the scraping of hides produced piles of animal flesh and fat which had to be disposed of. The term glover suggests John was only dealing with the finished leather product, but he is also at times referred to as a dresser of leather or a witterer. Both terms suggest that he may have been involved in tanning leather too, so his spoil heap may have been more noxious than the usual household waste and hence came to the attention of the constables. Some commentators have honed in on this evidence and used it to declare John as antisocial and rebellious in the face of authority, at best, and barbarous at worst. It was Sigmund Freud who said that. Some very recent research suggests that this is very unfair. The problem is with the word fined, which we take to mean as a punishment. But the suggestion is that the meaning has changed over time, and the fine was actually an understood means of taxation. As in, if you keep a private midden for your convenience, then you will be charged for it. John was then renting part of a house in Henley Street, and within a few years had purchased two other properties, one of which was later joined with the Henley Street property, and which can still be seen and visited today as the centre of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust in Stratford. It is a typical building of the time, of brick and timber on three levels, and with gabled windows looking out onto Henley Street. We can't be certain when he moved in there, but it became a family home once he married Mary Arden, and that happy event must have been sometime between late 1556, when she's mentioned in her father's will evidently still a spinster, and late 1558, when a first child was born to the couple. Mary Arden was the youngest daughter of a local well-to-do farming family who could probably trace their ancestry back to the Norman conquests. She was about 10 years younger than John Shakespeare, and it must have been considered a good match for him. Perhaps even something that the elder Shakespeare and Arden had eyed for years. Connections between families were very important at this time, as extended family support networks were vital to advancement in life. Mary seems to have been something of a favourite of her father, which is perhaps not surprising as she was the youngest of a large brood of children. When he died in 1556, he left standard bequests to his wife and his other children, but to Mary, in addition to this, he left an estate in Wilmcote, a village about 3 miles east of Stratford. It was probably his most valuable possession. As another sign of the esteem in which Mary was held by her father, she was named as one of the executors in his will, despite her relatively young age. John and Mary's first daughter, Joan, was baptised on the 15th of September 1558. This was in the last days of the reign of Mary. Elizabeth would ascend to the throne the following month, so it would have been a Catholic baptism. The subsequent 7 children would have all received Anglican baptisms. By the time their second child, Margaret, was baptised in early December 1562, the local vicar with his Catholic sentiments and history, who had performed the earlier baptism, had been ousted. The townspeople withheld his stipend when he refused to leave, and was replaced by the bookish, one might even say scholarly, John Brechgirdle, a graduate of Oxford University. Having baptised Margaret, he had the sad task of burying her just a few months later. On the 26th of April, 1564, the same vicar recorded the baptism of a son. The record, in Latin, simply reads, William, Father John Shakespeare. Which is how we have the date of William's baptism, but not his birth. The tradition is, of course, that Shakespeare was born on the 23rd, which is not unreasonable, but by no means certain. Babies, because of the risk of infant death, were generally baptised quickly at the time. If a baby was very ill at birth, then baptism could be undertaken immediately, because, theologically speaking, there was little that was worse than the death of an unbaptised baby. But the Player Book of 1559 gives advice in a different way. It only states that under normal circumstances, baptism should not be delayed beyond the next Sunday or holy day after the birth, and if it needs to be so delayed, then the permission of the vicar should be sought. Greater minds than mine have looked at the calendar for April 1564, and between the Sundays and the feast days, have calculated that if William was born on the 23rd, then he should have been baptised by the 25th. But even that's uncertain. St. Mark's Day, on the 25th of April, was considered unlucky, so may have been discounted for a baptism as part of that superstition. There is also the later evidence of William's tomb that says he died aged 53, not 52 or 54, on the 23rd of April. It's also been suggested that his granddaughter's choice to be married on the 22nd was to honour the birthday of her grandfather. Unfortunately, given the uncertainty of any precise dates for the period, wherever and however they are recorded, or indeed our understanding of the intentions of individuals in the Shakespeare family, all that we can say as far as Shakespeare's birth is concerned is that it was likely on the 21st, the 22nd, or the 23rd of April, 1564. Childhood, as we know, was a very dangerous time in the 16th century. But the summer of 1564 was a particularly risky one for a newborn. The plague had once again returned to the land, and its favourite victims were the very young and the very old. Its return was first recorded in Stratford on the 11th of July, and in total it would take 200 lives or more that summer. That's about one-sixth of the population of the town. The record shows some plague deaths in the very same street where Shakespeare lived. In August, the council gathered in the open air in the Chapel Gardens to discuss the situation, and John Shakespeare is recorded as being there. Somehow, the infant Shakespeare survived. We can speculate that he was perhaps removed from the town with his mother and lodged with her family in the slightly remoter lands where it was easier to isolate. Or perhaps he was just one of the lucky ones who did not contract the plague. Life goes on, and by December, the cold weather saw the end of the plague for that season. October 1566 saw the birth of the Shakespeare's second son, Gilbert. He was followed 3 years later by another daughter who was named Joan. The eldest daughter of the same name therefore must have died in the intervening years, although no church record of this has been found. Two more children would follow, and we know for sure that the last daughter, Anne, died in her seventh year in 1579. The church account book shows that John Shakespeare paid a fee of 8 pence for the ringing of the bell and for the pall, which is the cloth used to cover the coffin at a funeral. Another son, Richard, was baptised in March 1574, but no other details of his life are known. Their last child, Edmund, arrived in May 1580. By now, John, in his very late 40s, would have been taken for a rather elderly father. Like his brother, Edmund also caught the theatre bug and in time moved to London and became a professional player, although not one of any particular note. And he died young, at 27. His funeral at the Church of St. Mary Overy in Southwark is recorded unusually being held in the morning, with a forenoon knell of the great bell. The funeral cost 20 shillings, perhaps 10 times the amount that a cheaper burial could be had for, so it's tempting to think that his elder brother, by then earning some decent money, paid for his brother's funeral and made sure that he had a good send-off. The fact that the service was held unusually in the morning perhaps also suggests that a number of his fellow actors were in attendance, and the early start was to take into account their afternoon engagements playing at the theatres. But that is all in the future for John. As his family grew, so did his business interests. As well as his trade as a glover, he also had any income generated from the lands his wife had inherited and from the houses he owned and rented out. There's also a long-standing tradition that John had a sideline dealing in wool, the main commodity produced in the area. In the 19th century, the house in Henley Street had become a tavern, and it is recorded that when the floors were relaid in the building, there was much evidence of wool combing and other sheep-related detritus underneath the floorboards. Relatively recently, firm evidence of his wool business has emerged. In 1599, John and a business partner were fined for failing to pay £21 for 21 tods of wool, a deal that had apparently been struck many years before. A tod was nearly 30 pounds of wool in weight, so this was a significant amount of product. We don't know the outcome of the case, but it's good evidence that sometimes we should take historical traditions seriously. John is also recorded as having sold timber and barley, quite a lot of barley, actually. At the time, barley was the principal grain used for the production of beer and ale, another of Stratford's primary industries. So it seems that John had his finger in many pies, and it's quite possible that all of these sidelines revolve around the fact that he had space in his workshop, next to his home, to be used as storage for any goods that needed to be kept close to town. He also continued to buy houses and to let them, and his portfolio increased when two of Mary's sisters died, and she inherited a part share of houses that they owned. These were good years for John. He was often in court, like many Elizabethans in his position, as litigation was becoming a preferred route to resolve disputes. In 1572, he was awarded £50, that's close to £20,000 today, that he claimed a glover in Banbury owed him. But he also had his share of problems too, and on several occasions when being sued for debts, he didn't appear in court. Back in 1553, about the time when John moved to Stratford, the town received its charter of incorporation, allowing it to make bylaws and establishing the hierarchy of a town council, burgesses, and aldermen to manage local affairs. The local land magnate, the Earl of Warwick, retained certain tasks and also controlled a veto over some of the council decisions, so this was far from completely democratic local government, but it was an arena where a young and enthusiastic businessman like John Shakespeare could make his mark. Late in 1556, he was appointed as one of the two ale tasters for the town, a role that involved ensuring that bakers' loaves were up to weight and that the brewers were supplying their ale and beer as prescribed. Anyone who failed to impress John and his fellow taster could be sent to the local court and punished with a fine, a whipping, or incarceration in the stocks or the pillory. This is typical of the way that the Elizabethans regulated their economy. And John fell foul of that system himself when he failed to attend three sittings at the Court of Record in his capacity as a taster, for which omission he received a fine. Evidently that didn't blot his copybook too badly, as in 1558 he was sworn in as a constable, that is, an officer who had a general remit for preserving the peace. The following year he was witnessing the minutes of the Leet Court, where he was involved with assessing fines that were not explicitly prescribed by the bylaws, and at some time after this he was elected burgess, a position that he held until 1563. This was a trusted position, as it dealt with administering civic properties and revenues, and involved representing the town council to higher authorities. He then progressed to become a town chamberlain, and continued to act in that position even after the end of his term, so we can assume that he had fulfilled the function well. The town accounts that were presented in 1565 were signed off by John and fellow chamberlain John Taylor, and the following year they were reported by John Shakespeare alone. Council business and funds were generally about the upkeep of the civic buildings and lands and the rents that were collected from them, and how that income was then distributed out. But at this time, there was also a lot of work needed to turn the churches, built as Catholic places of worship, into buildings suitable for the new Protestant style. Walls had to be whitewashed, altar rails torn up, artifacts removed and destroyed. At about the same time, the vicar's house was also repaired, and a new classroom was added to the Guildhall. The entry in the town accounts for changes to the chapel next to the school, an item of expense also signed off by John Shakespeare and John Taylor, is particularly stark, and gives a feeling for the enormity of the changes being demanded at the time. Item: paid for defacing the images in the chapel, 2 shillings. It must have been a big job. 2 shillings would have paid for a dozen loaves of bread at the time, and we can imagine that signing off the work may not have been easy for men immersed in town life and no doubt civic pride. The chapel had been maintained by charity from the members of the Guild of the Holy Cross, a local organisation whose members, men and women, pledged to help each other in times of need and even beyond the grave. They attended members' funerals wearing their special monk-like hoods and arranged and paid for masses for the deceased members to be said to guide their souls from purgatory to heaven. But now this was all changed. The new church had abolished purgatory, reduced the role of prayer and forgiveness, and banned icons, frescoes, paintings, and all other types of decoration in churches. We don't know if John was a member of the guild, or the extent of his misgivings at following the orders he'd been given, but this particular chapel was highly decorated, and the contrast between what he had grown up with and the newly whitewashed walls must have been striking at least, and an emotional wrench for many. I wouldn't be the first commentator to point out that the whitewash did cover the decoration effectively, but it was just a thin layer, and a scratch on the wall would soon reveal what lay below. It's a good analogy for the way many people must have felt about the new religion. When, in 1565, a councillor was removed from the council for failing to appear before them to answer an accusation of speaking abusively about them and the bailiffs, John Shakespeare was elected in his place and became one of 14 aldermen. Holding this position, he could expect to be respectfully addressed as Goodman Shakespeare and could wear a special ring and a gown. In 1568, he became High Bailiff of the Council, the highest position that one could be elected to, equivalent of becoming mayor today. In this role, he presided over the Court of Record and at council meetings, where he would be referred to as Master Shakespeare. He also fulfilled the role of Borough Almoner, controlling the distribution of funds to the poor, and as the town coroner. He became a Justice of the Peace, issuing warrants and dealing with cases of debt and any other violation of the bylaws. This role would have brought him into direct meetings with the Earl of Warwick as the local lord. The fact that he was not re-elected as High Bailiff when his term came to an end is maybe the first hint of problems in his life. Whatever was going on then, it didn't stop John from starting the process of applying for a coat of arms. He got as far as submitting a design, but there the process stalled for unknown reasons. It was a project that would only come to fruition years later, and thanks to the effort of his son. In 1570, John was accused of usury. The lending of money was tightly controlled by law, with maximum interest rates being fixed. But it was also severely discouraged by those of Puritan leanings, so there was a moral dimension to the activity too. John lent Walter Mussum £220, which is equivalent to something like £35,000 today. When Mussum died, his estate was valued at only £114, so it seems that he wasn't a good risk. This wasn't John's only problem. The punishment for usury, judged illegal, could be the confiscation of the original loan and the interest and a fine on top of that. And there's some evidence of other deals that he made, and that the Exchequer was aware of his activities and they had their eyes on him. 1576 seems to be a significant year. It was then that John stopped attending council meetings. However, despite his continued absence, he was not expelled from the council. So it seems that his fellow councillors had some sympathy with his situation and were giving him a lot of leeway, while hoping that he would return. During this time, a demand for a levy to equip soldiers was passed by the council, and they allowed John to pay a reduced fee, just half of what he should have paid as an alderman. So that suggests John had some money problems, but again shows that his friends and colleagues on the council were supportive of him. In fact, as far as we know, he never did even pay that reduced sum. At the council elections in 1578, John was again absent, and should have been fined, but he was let off. Later that year, it was agreed that every alderman should pay 4 pence a week towards poor relief, but John Shakespeare and another alderman were explicitly excused from paying anything. It was only on the 6th of September 1586 that the council elected two new aldermen. The record says, "For that Mr. Wheeler doth desire to be put out of the company, and Mr. Shakespeare doth not come to the halls when they be warned, nor hath not done so for a long time." John's problems were by then quite long-standing. In November 1578, he mortgaged part of his wife's inheritance, the house in Wilmcote, for £40. When that sum fell due at Michaelmas 1580, John was unable to pay it and lost control of the property. He did try to recover it through hearings at the Queen's Bench in Westminster, but without success. Further land deals concerning Mary's inheritance were done with relatives taking control of the lands, so clearly the Shakespeares had a need for cash. Slowly, what had been an impressive portfolio of properties was stripped down to very little. In 1580, John was twice fined £20 in court, where he had offered security for others, who then defaulted. And it's not clear if either fine was ever collected. There are several examples of John standing surety for other people in the town, but evidently he was not the best judge of character, and he picked up several fines relating to default in these matters. And in perhaps a very worrying situation for him, in 1582 he petitioned for surety of the peace against four men, for fear of death and mutilation of his limbs. Again, it's not clear what the nature of the argument between these men and John Shakespeare was, but this was certainly not the behaviour expected towards a respected member of civic society. In 1591, it was John's spiritual health that became of concern. That's not to say that this was all about John specifically, but the Privy Council and the Archbishop of Canterbury launched into a drive to improve the spiritual health of the realm generally. Commissioners were ordered to find and report all of those who gave sanctuary to seminary priests, Jesuits, and other fugitives. In March the following year, the church wardens of Stratford drew up a list of those who did not attend church regularly, as people were required to do by law, and they said, "We suspect these nine persons next ensuing absent themselves for fear of process." John Shakespeare's name appears on that list. When a second list was drawn up, the same nine were mentioned again. It is said that these last nine come not to church for fear of process of debt. So it seems that John and others feared coming to church because those collecting a debt could wait there, knowing that they should turn up, and thus the spiritual and the economic world became entwined. Some have suggested that John's reluctance to attend church comes not from a fear of a debt collector, but for more ideological or theological reasons, suggesting that he was rebelling against the new religion and therefore displaying Catholic sympathies. The Midlands of England did have many Catholic families who maintained their faith throughout the worst of times for them, but there seems to be little evidence of any strong religious feelings that John might have had, except for an alleged last testament that was thought to be written by him and espoused Catholic leanings. But the authorship of this was always dubious, and is now thought likely to have been written by his granddaughter. John was a tradesman, and a man happy to function as part of the civic apparatus of the time, both of which roles would demand at least skin-deep adherence to the new faith. The last thing a tradesman wanted was ostracism from the community, and it is unlikely that anybody could advance themselves in the way that John did without good church attendance. Therefore, it does seem most likely that his reasons for not appearing in church or at the council meetings in the later years were driven by a fear of the debt collectors. We don't know the exact nature of John's financial problems, but there was what we would now think of as a small recession in the Midlands of England at the time, and there is evidence of other traders struggling to pay debts. That the registered poor in the community was growing is another indication of financially fraught times, so John's problems may have been unavoidable, or perhaps he was too adventurous in some of his dealings at the wrong time. Whatever caused his effective withdrawal from public life in Stratford in 1576, he continued to live in the town, and presumably forged some lower-key lifestyle that escapes the surviving record. In September 1594, a fire swept through Stratford, a disaster that was interpreted by many as a sign of God's displeasure. And then, a year later, another fire meant that, in all, over 100 houses were destroyed or severely damaged in that year. The fire came very close to engulfing the house on Henley Street, which was John's only remaining property by then, and the one that he retained until his death in 1601. Even to the end of his life, it seems that John was still a respected member of the community, despite his reduced position. Earlier in that year, He was one of the people chosen to represent the town by signing a declaration opposing the activities of a local lord of the manor, Sir Edward Greville. He didn't live to see the outcome of that dispute. When he died, he was in his early 70s, and records show that he was buried in the churchyard with a gravestone. But this has long since been lost. So what to make of John Shakespeare's rise and fall? Perhaps first we have to question if there really was a fall. The traditional interpretation was certainly that, and saw John as a failed businessman, perhaps even a bit of a rogue who overreached himself and caused the ruin of his family. A man who, thanks to his son, got his recognition as a gentleman in his final years of decline. It seems that this is likely an unfair assessment. Perhaps we should see John Shakespeare more as one of the growing band of Elizabethan tradesmen who had successful careers and advanced their social position. A man who took his chances, but lacked character judgment, and thanks to some poor business decisions, went through a bad patch in his business dealings. More or less 20 years of apparent decline are problematic to the biographer. Yet, he does seem to have recovered his social position by the time he died, if indeed he ever lost it. We shouldn't forget that he rose through the civic ranks to become a mayor, no mean achievement by any standard. How far his religious beliefs were involved in his troubles is another factor that remains mysterious to us today, but I'll perhaps come back to that another time. Next time, the focus will be on John's eldest son as he grows up in Stratford. No doubt aware of his father's position in the town's society and perhaps reaping the benefit of it, but perhaps also becoming aware of the difficulties of earning a living in Elizabethan England. In the meantime, please join the Facebook page or group, or find the podcast on Instagram or X to keep up to date with new episodes and other theatre-related stuff. If you do feel able to help out with the costs of running the podcast, then please head over to Patreon, where you will find additional content for a small monthly fee or a one-off donation. You can find details of ways to support the podcast on the website, which is www.thehistoryofeuropeantheatre.com. I look forward to your company next time, but if you do have any comments or concerns in the meantime, you can contact me by email at thoetp@gmail.com or via X at thoetp. Thank you.